So this morning, I want to talk about transforming greed into generosity. What a nice theme. Greed into generosity. At the center of the wheel that I've been talking about in my last few talks, the wheel of conditioning, the wheel of keeps us in this fix of being caught by our past, being caught by our past anxieties, our past worries, our past screw-ups, and projecting those into the future so that we act reactively, continually. At the center of the of that wheel is greed, and it's a pig. The picture is of a pig. There are three others. There are two others that are at the center of it, the rooster and the snake. And possibly next time I talk, I'll talk about those. But greed, the pig. Let's start there. So greed is a form of desire, right? A form of desire. Not a very pleasant form. I mean, it's probably not fair to the pig, but the way we think about it, it's not a very pleasant form of desire. And paradoxically, the world runs on desire. It runs on desire. Without desire, you guys wouldn't be here today. Without desire, I wouldn't have given up half my Saturday to think about what I'm going to talk about this morning. Right? Without desire, da 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 da. Without desire, we wouldn't have a human species. We wouldn't perpetuate the human species. So desire, that's how the world runs. This idea that Buddhism is about desirelessness, I think you should forget that idea. Because really, when there's no desire left, what happens? We die. We die. And if you worked, as I did when I was younger, with people who contemplate suicide, it's after they go through their despair that then they, they just give up everything. All desires, even the despairing desire, that they usually are ready to try suicide. So we need to acknowledge that. That the world runs on desire. That this is a human situation, and it's not good or bad. It's just what is. Right? It's just what is. Of course, meditation can have effect on that—a good effect, but also sometimes a little bit of a lopsided effect. In my own case, when I was young, I practiced very diligently. A lot of practice, a lot of sitting, meditation, 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 quiet, 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 quiet. Spent time immersed in a monastic setting in California. Was very, very sincere. Then I came back into the world I was so calm and so accepting that I was kind of out of touch with my own desires, if that's possible. And it is possible. It is possible. Now, was that a deep calmness and a deep acceptance? Probably not. Probably not, because I had to spend some time over the next years learning how to be in touch with and work with my desires. And I know the period that I was out of touch with them, I was so calm and so enlightened, right? We're very hard on my wife. Very, very hard on her. For a number of reasons. So, maybe none of you were going to have that problem, but you could. You could. And it's something to pay attention to. So Buddhism differentiates very strongly, although not too strongly, between healthy desire and unhealthy desire. And there are whole lists of unhealthy ones and healthy ones. kind of boring lists after a while. You just want to close the book or do your own, make up your own lists, because, you know, they list everything, the 32 unhealthy ones, the 33 healthy ones, on and on and on. And, you know, they do it numerically because it's an oral tradition. And by remembering that this is number 18, it helps them use it for their practice. So healthy desires I've been particularly aware of with my daughter and her mothering, as my grandsons have been here. They've just gone back to Paris, where they live. And I see my daughter's desire about her 4-year-old. Her 4-year-old is French, and he's American, right? But he's lived his whole life in France. So when he wants to go outside, he goes out. This is actually what happens. In the backyard, he goes out without his pants on. When he's at the beach, the Lake Calhoun beach, he takes his pants off. And Aaron's trying to teach him this is a different culture. 4-year-old boys do not go outside with their pants on. People get freaked out. So that's her healthy desire. Her healthy desire is for him to get the difference between the two cultures and get along in this culture too. Not be ostracized because of his naked butt, right? Which actually in the park, when I saw him starting to take his pants off, I saw the parents starting to pull their children away. It's really just sort of unconsciously. I don't even kind of know they're doing it. They're just doing it. What is this kid into? Well, what he's into is a different culture, which is neither better nor worse. He just has been in that different culture for 4 years. So healthy desire. My 4-year-old grandson is really a picky eater, although I don't say it in front of him because that's not helpful. We've all disciplined ourselves not to say it in front of him. But so since he only wants to eat carbs and tofu, well, tofu is a form of carb. That's all he'll eat. You know, the rule at dinner is if he wants a sweet, he has to try 3 foods or 3 colors, as Mom said, 3 colors. Well, that's a healthy desire that she has. The kid is 4. He lives in a culture, basically a meat-eating culture. He won't touch meat. We're always trying to put a little chicken in there, and because, you know, but and once in a while I'll have a little. But he's on to it. He knows that it's meat. And problem is he won't touch much besides carbs. So a healthy desire for him to get enough protein, for him to be strong, for him to get along in a culture which is primarily meat-eating. Aaron does this. And then instead of TV at night, because of her healthy desire for him not to be dependent on TV, Grandpa tells stories, or someone else tells stories. And he says he wants to watch a little TV, and Aaron says, well, Grandpa will tell you an extra story instead. Mm-hmm. He said, no. Well, Grandpa will tell you 2 extra stories. Oh, all right, or something like that, right? So healthy desire. Healthy desire. But desire and desire, even healthy desire, very quickly solidifies, calcifies into what? Compulsion, fixation, and then even addiction. We know that. We can watch that. And often we don't notice the transition. It happens before we've seen it. My sister and I, one of our earliest memories is of having to eat soft-boiled eggs that our mother fixed us. Because this doctor I liked a lot, told my mother that we were both very small for our age, that we should eat she should make soft-boiled eggs for us every morning. We hated them. It's one of our yuckiest memories. We had to sit in our chairs. I remember having to sit in my high chair, and I couldn't get down till I'd either eaten those soft-boiled eggs. I won't get into it too much. I see you guys getting grossed out. Or leave. That's fixation. That I should have that as one of a predominant memory of my childhood does not associate eggs in my repertoire of feelings, things that I have a positive feeling about, and it generalizes to a lot of other things because of that early memory. So this is tricky. It's subtle, isn't it? So, and then we have our worldwide desires. As cultures, we have desires. Well, for instance, in American culture, the desire is that a four-year-old will go out in public with his pants on. In French culture, if it's a boy, no. If it's a girl, yes. Oh, seems weird, but any culture you look at is weird. if you look at it from a point of view of another culture, right? So, worldwide, we have desires and we have compulsions. We have fixations. And I've had conversations with some of you lately and with my friends. It seems like I've been having these conversations with people for 10 years about the American compulsion for comfort, for security, seems to be kind of a worldwide compulsion now. And the acquisitiveness that goes along with that. And global warming is certainly an example, isn't it? Global warming is an example. 95% of the scientists in the world now say that global warming is a given. It shouldn't be debated. And 10 years ago, it was 90%. But where are we as a human species in regard to that? Where are we as Americans in regard? I'm sure that all of you in this room get it, but go outside of this room. Go outside, educated people, people who took science in college, who studied biology in high school, and what are we doing? Are we on the way to ending the human species because of our addiction to comfort and security? I don't know, but it's possible. It's possible. So sometimes we indulge in desires, and then the simple thing is to set limits for ourselves and discipline ourselves in a gentle way. I happen to be kind of a chocolate fiend. You know, I'm not a chocolate fiend when I don't see chocolate. It's true, when I don't taste chocolate. But when I see and taste chocolate, I turn into a chocolate fiend. So, I just have to watch that. I have to pay attention to that. I have to set a limit. And similarly, when we shut down, when we push away our desires, when we condemn our desires, then we need to begin to discover that we have healthy desires, that it's there. And shutting down is not good for us or good for those around us. Again, example from my own life. When my son was during the first 9 years of my son's life, we lived, my wife and I and my son and then my daughter, we lived in little tiny apartments or trailers. In northern Minnesota, we lived in a tiny trailer in the middle of the woods for more than 2 years. Then we lived in a farmhouse with holes in the ceilings, and we patched it up so the rain wouldn't get in most of the time, and the walls. We did that for 3 years. And we moved down here, and we lived in a tiny little duplex for, I don't know, another 3 or 4 years. And finally, my wife said, you know, I want to have a house like other people. And I think it was my underlying compulsion, my compulsive desire not to be dependent on material things. So finally my wife said, well, I'm just going to buy this house. And then she went out and bought it. And now we've been there now for years and years and years. It's just a house, you know. Just a house. But I was kind of shut down. So it's something we just should pay attention to, that's all. That's all. Just pay attention to it. And goals. So goals. Goals are a form of desire, right? And we should have goals. We should have goals. And you know, it's pretty easy to tell whether our goals are healthy or unhealthy, isn't it? Are we trying to prove our worthiness? If we're trying to prove our worthiness, maybe that's not a very healthy goal. Are we trying to beat out others? Have the best Zen center? All these Zen centers? The most something or other Zen center? That's maybe not too healthy. Are we trying to cover our basic insecurity? Maybe not. But commitment, love, caring, goals that are revolve around that are noble. What we need as human beings to live satisfying lives and to support ourselves and others. And even our healthy desires, we need to learn to take lightly. Lightly. And that's kind of what the meditation practice helps us to do. So a desire that we have at Zen Center, that especially the board of directors is assigned to have, people don't realize it sometimes when they join the board, is to make sure that Zen Center is getting enough income to support itself. And that happens to be needs to be a major focus. And as long as it's a healthy focus, as long as it's for the welfare of all people, as long as it's not to show off, as long as it's to help people calm down, including yourself, including your own desire, it's cool. It's cool. So meditation. What about meditation? Well, that's the second important way, I think, that we deal with desire, with greed in particular, but all our desires. The first way is to really assess and develop the healthy ones. Meditation. So those of you who are new to meditation may have noticed how you may have been shocked. And if you're not shocked yet, then meditate a little bit more. Come back and meditate. At how many desires come up in 3 minutes of time. Really. I suggest that those of you who are meditators or beginning meditators, during the next week, if you're not sitting here because it will distract people here, after your first 3 minutes of sitting, take a notebook out and write down all the desires that have come up in those 3 minutes. You will be amazed. You might even be appalled, but it's what's going on already. It's what's going on already. So that's one of the first things in the meditation process that we notice is how we're prey to all of this stuff, all this toing and froing and worrying over and over and over again. And also in meditation retreats, when we have longer retreats, some people said, well, maybe after the first day I cannot be obsessed by these desires. And they feel that. Sometimes it takes 2 days. Sometimes it takes 3 days. Sometimes it takes 4 days. Sometimes people will sit for a whole 5 days and still it'll be mostly just churning out desire. And that's kind of discouraging sometimes. Kind of discouraging. But it's what happens. It's what happens. And it's not bad. We have to see it and recognize it and accept it to be free from it. If there's no seeing, no recognition, how can there be acceptance? And without acceptance, how can there be freedom? Pretty simple. But it is discouraging for a lot of people. And when I was younger, it was discouraging for me. So about 3 or 4 years ago, I was leading a retreat here, and I'm changing this enough so you cannot figure out who I'm talking about. So please, don't go down that path. I was sitting in a retreat here and leading the retreat, and after the first day, maybe, I don't know, it was a 7-day retreat, maybe the second day, the guy came up to my room and he said, oh, sexual desire. He said, on the wall, in my mind, in my head, in my body, over and over and over again. He said, that's all it is. That's all it is. Help. Well, what am I going to do? I mean, really, what am I going to do? Except say, oh, yes, good for you. You're seeing it. You're letting it be. Don't mess with it. You're starting to judge it. You're getting upset with it. I know that, but don't mess with it. Just be with it and come back to being here, to being present in your body, in your breathing. So maybe a day or two later, he comes in. And the next day he comes in and it's the same. Maybe in the next day he comes in. So I don't remember this exactly. And I said, well, how is it? He said, oh, it's not any better. And I said, well, tell me a little bit about it. He said, well, it's not about sex anymore. And I said, oh? He said, yeah, it's about loneliness. It's about feeling cut off. It's about feeling like I don't have any friend except this wall, and this wall is certainly not a friend. It's the least friendly being I've ever seen. It gives me nothing back. Nothing nurturing, nothing supporting. It's loneliness. Loneliness. And of course, that's not surprising, is it? Sexual imagery usually is about the urge to merge, isn't it? Loneliness is feeling cut off. This is a guy who lives by himself. I don't know if he's ever had a partner. I didn't know him that well. Lives by himself, works by himself, and then comes, sits, and faces the wall by himself in his free time. What a deal. So loneliness. Loneliness. And then, something like the next day, or I don't know, before the retreat was over, he comes in and he seems really calm. And I say, how are you doing? And he says, great. And I said, well, did the loneliness go away? He said, no. He said, but I thought about what Buddha said. Only I, alone and sacred, and realize that I was that I, that everything is that I. Well, I said something like, wonderful, congratulations, but don't think about it, just go back and sit some more. Because, you know, we so easily then make something out of it. So his grasping, his clinging, dropped away. It drops away at some point, on its own, in its own time. Nothing to do with human time, in its own time. And that's what I've called in my last talk, on my talk before, falling into the space between the different links in the chain. Falling into the space between sensation and emotional intention. Falling into the space between emotional intention and action, whether it be action of the mind, the thoughts, the body, falling into that space and realizing that that space is your anchor. Is your anchor. Only you, alone and sacred, but your anchor. So this is what some Buddhist teachers call discovering the abundance that is beyond desire. And what Suzuki Roshi, my first teacher, called discovering beginner's mind, returning to beginner's mind. We're beginners because we experience abundance. Abundance. Because things are. Just because things are. Because there is color. Because there is sound. Because there is desire. Abundant. And when I was talking about this once, a long time ago, when I went down to a group in Iowa, a woman said to me, well, that sounds like prosperity consciousness to me. And I said, oh, what's prosperity consciousness? She said, well, you should watch TV. Well, since then, I watched quite a few of these shows. I didn't watch very much of them on prosperity consciousness. That's not what this is about. Prosperity consciousness is visualizing that you can have it all. That you can have wealth and sex and marriage and kids, and then going for it. Well, this is really the opposite of that. This is the opposite of that. It's abundance that comes from abandoning the need to be anything more than what we are already. Abandoning that. Which means we still have goals, but we don't cling to them. They aren't the be and all, end all of our existence. But then in Buddhist thought, there is one exception to this, and you can take this for what it's worth, but I think it's worth mentioning. And that is big desire. Big desire is considered really cool in Buddhism. Really cool. Big desire. Desire for the happiness of all beings. Desire that all beings, including me, will fall into that spaciousness and that will be our anchor. That big desire is referred to, many of you know this, as relative bodhicitta. Bodhi means awake. Citta means thought. So the thoughts of living wakefully, the thoughts of living with healthy desire, and then even not being fixated on healthy desire, but just being present in the world, just being available. That thought, if it's a big thought, if it's a big desire, is considered exactly the same as, those of you who studied this know, relative bodhicitta is considered the same as absolute bodhicitta. Again, bodhi, awake, only here the meaning of citta has changed from thinking to mind. So the thoughts of living wakefully are none other than a manifestation of the mind that's already awake, the mind that sees grasping but doesn't get caught by it, that sees anger but doesn't get caught by it. Sometimes it needs to express anger. That's fine. This is not about repressing. It just doesn't get caught. It sees it. The mind that really feels that there is inner abundance, that there's always inner abundance regardless of our condition. And the story that I've told lots of times here, but probably not in 2 years, which I'm going to use it as an example, is the story of my son when he was tiny and he loved strawberries. So you were smiling because you've heard this story so many times. So he loved strawberries, and we, instead of calling him just Jed, which is the first name, we called him Jed Berry. And we lived in the country, so we always, in strawberry season, he would be out there picking strawberries like crazy and then eating them. So one morning, if I remember this right, I've told this story so many times, but I can't remember how I told it, how I tell it. But anyway, as I remember it, somebody was out picking strawberries, and it wasn't Jed. Mosquitoes were really bad in the morning, so it was someone who went out with long sleeves on, picked strawberries, and brought them in for us to have for breakfast. So there we are, we're having our strawberries for breakfast, and there's just enough for me, my wife, and my son. And they're kind of evenly distributed because strawberries. Talk about craving wild strawberries. So equal amount. I'm eating mine in my one-pointed manner. And I notice that Jed eats his, and then I notice that Jed's eating Linda's. And only about 5 minutes gone by, and they're all gone, but Jed has eaten all of Linda's and all of his. And I said to Linda, well, you love strawberries. Jed ate all your strawberries. And she said, yes, but how good they tasted. Relative bodhicitta is absolute bodhicitta. And a mother knows that. mother knows that, especially in regard to his or her, her children. The father, to a lesser degree, unfortunately. Well, somewhat. Somewhat. But. So, when I was with my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, he did many, many things right from his heart. Many, many generous things. And I didn't see greed in him. I'm sure it was there, but I just didn't see him act on his greed. Of course, by that time he was pretty old. He was pretty old. And once I was talking to his son about his son, who was a barber in San Francisco. I talked to his son, Otohiro, and I said, you know, your father, he's so generous. He's so generous. And then I talked about some of the things he'd done, like when we had a little group in my hometown, a little sitting group, and I was in college, and my father was paying for me to go to college, and you know, I was driving in, I guess, a nice car, I don't know. They would collect an offering in the morning for him coming down, because he came all the way down every morning, and then he would try to give it to me. You say, this is yours, you set this up. I said, no. Well, he was living on a tenth the salary, a twentieth the salary that my father made, a thirtieth the salary. So anyway, I said these things to Otohiro, and Otohiro said, that's not the father that I remember. Not the father that I remember. So there are two things about that. One is, let's not idealize people. And the other is, this takes a while. This takes a while, you guys. It just does. Like anything that you really care about, anything that you really give yourself to, it takes a while to penetrate your psyche. So there are two other practices that I want to talk about briefly in regard to the transformation of greed into generosity. These are all typical Buddhist practices. One is the gassho. In Japan, if you do monastic work, if you're in a monastery, you're thanking for everything, Always thankful, always gassho-ing. Doesn't matter what happens. You know, if Suzuki used to say, if you're anxious, gassho. If you're upset, gassho. If you're bored, what do? Gassho. And that was his teaching. That was also Hojo-san's, Katagiri Roshi's teaching. And that's a great teaching. In this culture, I don't know. Sometimes we do a lot of this here. Sometimes we don't do much of it. And some retreats we have none. Because we have to develop in our culture our own way of manifesting gratitude, of manifesting connectedness. And for a couple more generations, we can depend on this. But at some point, even the Chinese teachers, when I talked with Red Pine, he said, all this gassho-ing. He said, in China, they would never do that. I said, well, you know, our teachers are Japanese. And the Chinese have a different way of expressing gratitude. So there's this African proverb that says, it is the heart that gives, the fingers just let go. So after a while, this practice enters yourselves, and you're able just to let go. And also, in Buddhist centers like our center, we have practices of giving. Practices daily practices. We chant about freeing all beings from suffering, freeing all beings from disaster and misfortune. And we do that wholeheartedly. We vow, we have a little chant before and after the talk in which we're practicing giving. We're vowing to give. And the last way that we cultivate the transformation of greed into generosity in Zen centers and in Zen Buddhism in particular, historically, is through cultivating and appreciating beauty. Beauty. If you know anything about Zen or Buddhist art, if you know about how a Zen center is a look, if you know about calligraphy, look at that piece of calligraphy on the wall underneath Manoj. That was Katagiri's piece of calligraphy. You don't have to know anything about Buddhism or about meditation to see that and feel something. It slows your mind down and you feel something. Maybe you don't, but I do, and I did in the beginning when I first saw it. In my other life, I'm opening a program now in an old mansion. Or my staff are opening a program in an old mansion, a beautiful turn of the century mansion that is in the inner city. So we're buying it for almost nothing, my nonprofit. For people with mental illness and chemical dependency. And the thing about this place is that it's still got all the hardwood floors, that it's still got all the original woodwork, that it's got everything. And everything's been preserved. It has there's a calming feeling, a feeling of spaciousness when you go in, even the tiny room, even the tiny entryway. And so I took my friend there who's a psychiatrist and going to work with us. And when we left, we were talking about the program that we were going to be doing and all this stuff. He said to me, you know, I think the things that will help folks most who come to live here will be the beauty. The beauty. He said, I think that will help them with their addiction more than anything. More than anything. Do you believe it? Do you believe it? Think of yourself. Think about when you're really moved by something you see. And your mind is going really fast and you're really upset. And then you just stop and you look at that. You look at the lake. You look at that piece of calligraphy. You look at the flower arrangement. Every morning I come in here in the morning. And after sitting, I come up here and I bow. And I pass this flower arrangement. If my mind is all distracted, I see its beauty. I see its, and I feel something wonderful. Something wonderful. Just the way these flowers are arranged with the leaves underneath. And they're not, it's not arbitrary. It's alive. So beauty, the cultivation of beauty and the appreciation of beauty. This Zen center, taking care of this Zen center so that people feel comfortable here, so that people feel at home here. We were closed for a week and a lot of people worked on painting, on working on the porch, on many things. So when I came in after the week was over, I just felt, I went upstairs. I had a different feeling. So taking care of our environment, taking care of our environment, appreciating. So those are the things that I want to talk about this morning. And now I want to read something about how you might spend... Well, first of all, I suggest that during the next week that you all spend 3 minutes one day sitting quietly with a pen and a piece of paper next to you and writing down all your desires. No editing, no judging allowed. I'm kidding, because you know if the judging comes in, that's you just say judging. That's one of your desires, not to be judging. So writing them all down. And then I also suggest that you spend some time, maybe take a half hour or a few minutes, doing some daily life exercise, kind of like this one that Jack Kornfield talks about. As you go about your daily rounds, first notice the gifts of the natural world. Notice the way the gift of sunlight streams behind everything. It feeds the plants we eat and gives us the oil from ancient forests that fuels our cars and lights our lamps at night. Notice, too, the rainfall and the rivers, the water that gives itself to the blood in your veins, to the neighborhood of insects and trees, to the interdependent collaborative in which we swim. Now notice how generously you are held and supported by the earth under your home and your feet, by the air you breathe, by the warmth of the day and the coolness of the evening. Now look at the unending care and generosity in humans around you. Parents with children, teachers with students, healers and business people, all serving one another. People stop at red lights so you are safe to go. They line up in the market. They share the parks. They cooperate in a thousand ways at the office. The shopkeeper and the mechanic, the bank teller and the cook, the healer and the engineer give themselves to their work, supporting others with countless hours of unspoken generosity and love. Of course, there are also times of resentment and being overwhelmed when people are disgruntled and disaffected. But most of the time, the people around you are giving, in conversation, in action, adding the generosity of their life to the flow of the whole. Spend a day or a week just noticing, naming, bowing to the stream of generosity everywhere. Now you can deliberately choose to add to this stream of generosity, not as an obligation, but as a way to be happy. Like all human beings, you already give in a myriad of ways. Delight in whatever you do, and discover you can let it grow. Try this practice. Whenever a thought of giving enters your mind, do it. Whether it is a gift of money, time, helping care, or offering a possession, if you even think of it as a generous act, follow it. Sometimes we worry that we will regret our generous acts. We second-guess ourselves, and a bit of doubt comes in. Don't believe the doubts. Instead, look for any spontaneous thoughts of generosity and follow them. You will find that they will inevitably make you happy. So that's Jack Kornfield's advice. So let me close with the Lotus Sutra. The richest person in the world, having been laboring and struggling endlessly, does not understand that already he possesses all that he seeks. Does not understand that he already possesses all that he seeks. That's what I would like to say this morning. So, questions, comments?
Question.
Sure.
You had mentioned that talking about relative or chitta, and I think the biggest desire actually is one of absolute. Yeah. And I'm sure, could you just talk a little bit about how that relates to absolute truth or relative truth? I'm sure it's specific.
Well, let's just. So my example was the example that I used. Did you so you thought the example that I used did not help?
It made sense to me. When you said that there, I get confused sometimes. I have debates with sometimes about, like, one person will say it's all the absolute, everything is just all the absolute. It's like, well, I thought there was absolute and relative, and here we are in a relative world, even though yes, it's arising out of the absolute. So, anyway, I just was kind of trying to get a little bit of clarification. Is it similar when we're talking relative bodhicitta and absolute to relative truth and absolute?
It's supposed to be. I mean, meaning that's how they talk about it. So the analogy, another analogy I use, Dean, I probably overuse, is the waves in the ocean. That the wave is just the wave. It doesn't last long. It's always changing. But also it's the entire ocean. It's the complete ocean. And it's endless. But it's just the wave. In its current form, it lasts a second. And yet it's the whole ocean. I mean, how could it not be? Well, then each, how could it not be? That's another analogy, but I don't know if that's helpful to you. Talking about this philosophically, I rather use analogies than talk philosophically, because when we start to talk philosophically, we start compartmentalizing. And then you know, then we really get mixed up. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I can talk philosophically, but I know that stuff, but I don't know if that's helpful. samsara and nirvana, right? The samsaric world, the world of struggling. The desire is to get out of that world, to get out of that struggling, to the nirvanic world. Nirvanic meaning when we blow all that craving and grasping out. We want to move from this samsaric, screwed up life or moment to the moment where we've blown out that struggling, that self-injurious behavior, and injurious behavior to others. We want to blow that out. But the actual paying attention to it, the actual being with it, even the self-injurious thoughts and the self-injurious behavior, with kind attention, that's nirvana. That's nirvana. With a non-grasping, just being with it. That's where the space comes up. It doesn't come up anyplace else. But in being with that, in being with that sexual imagery, in being with that loneliness, being with that aloneness, beginning to see the space that is within it and that surrounds it. It's not separate from it, but it is there. And it doesn't negate it, because it never goes away. Without waves, how can there be an ocean? How can there be an ocean? Other people? Yeah, Larry.
Could you talk a little bit about the second noble truth that the cause of suffering is desire?
Yeah, and of course, I much prefer the translation, the cause of suffering is craving, than desire. I think desire takes us down the wrong path when we say that. So I much prefer craving, grasping. Some Buddhist scholars will argue with me, and some Buddhist practitioners will argue with me too, and that's okay. I mean, you know, but I've just seen that. I've seen that go into world denial and self denial and pleasure denial too often in my own case and in others.
So like the I think that's what you're talking about earlier in terms of desires. Craving, would you say, is sort of like a solidification of desire?
You could say that. You could say that. It's a fixation. It's a like, without this, I'm not alive. I need this. I mean, my poor mother felt that somehow if we didn't eat those soft-boiled eggs, we'd only grow to be 5'6". Well, we only grew to be 5'6" anyway. My sister grew to be 5'2", and me 5'6". We ate all those fucking soft-boiled eggs. Excuse me. Sorry, but my stuff coming up, right? My stuff coming up.
Have another soft-cooked story.
Okay.
This is actually a story from the life of my former wife. She was in a family. Her father was a career Army officer, and he was stationed in Alaska. And the whole family was living there. My wife was a young kid at that time, of course, and her younger brother and even younger sister. And her parents liked to go fishing in the Kenai Peninsula, so they would pitch a tent and go out for a week or 5 days or something like that. And her mother would cook scrambled eggs, but she soft-cooked them, so they were kind of soft and mushy. And the kids hated them. So one morning, they were sitting at the picnic table eating their breakfast or avoiding eating the eggs. And the kids just weren't eating the eggs at all. And the parents said, okay, you kids are going to stay here until you eat your eggs. Mm. We're going to go off and we're going to go fish. So the parents went off and started fishing. And Lynn organized her brother and her sister and said, look, we can just scrape these eggs into the water here, empty the plates, and we'll be all done. So they did that. And of course, the eggs floated downstream past her parents. We were very upset.
Great story. Okay, thank you so much, and hope you can stick around for our coffee and tea.